Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 11540, State v. Cotiabad. Arguing for the petitioner, Brandon Ito. Arguing for the respondent, Craig Jerome. Argument on the merits.
Counsel, are you both ready to proceed?
Yes.
Okay, very well. And Mr. Ito, my understanding is you've reserved 15 minutes for rebuttal, so a yellow light will come on to warn you when you get to that point in your argument. Mr. Jerome, you've asked for and we'll give you a five-minute warning with 5 minutes left to go in your argument. Is that right? Okay, please proceed. Thank you.
May it please the court. Brandon Ito, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for the state. The words touching a person in an offensive manner are factually synonymous with the words subjecting another person to offensive physical contact. According to the IC in this case, however, a distinction exists between an offensive physical contact and the touching of another person in an offensive manner. Based on this interpretation of the Pessenfeiner case, subsection 1E of the harassment statute describes two totally different types of conduct because subjecting a person to offensive physical contact apparently has an independent and separate meaning from touching a person in an offensive manner. The state respectfully disagrees. A closer reading of the Pessenfeiner opinion reveals that the opinion's weight for precedent purposes cannot placed on the Pessenfeiner support, the Pessenfeiner court's attempt to delineate alternative means in subsection 1A of the harassment statute. Instead, the weight accorded to the opinion should be placed on the specific holding that appears at the end of the court's consideration of the issue, namely that the holding is quite simply that the conduct at issue in this case was covered by subsection 1A of the harassment statute and covered quite fairly. So again, the words touching a person in an offensive manner are factually synonymous with the words subjecting another person to offensive physical contact for the reasons already set forth in the state's application as well as its reply.
If it's factually synonymous, then are you making that portion of the statute surplusage or nugatory? I mean, isn't that what the ICA said when they interpreted it?
No, I don't think it's necessarily surplusage to the extent that it also helps assist, for example, a person of common understanding what exactly is being charged here. So I don't think it's necessarily surplusage. I'm not sure which part you would be referring to as being surplusage.
So that's the only purpose of that second portion of the statute is for notice to help explain the first part?
Well, it's conceivable that subjecting another person to offensive physical contact could be broader, could include touchings that are contacts that are broader than just
like knocking off a hat or pulling a tie or things of that nature.
Or somebody shoving person A into person B and we charge the defendant with harassment of person B. That's not necessarily touching per se.
So that would not make those two clauses or phrases factually synonymous then?
I think it does. I mean, the word synonym by definition is a word that means the same or nearly the same as another word. And ordinarily defined, contact is touching.
What about the argument by the, defense that the first part of it, strike, shoves, kicks, or otherwise touches another person, involves direct physical contact, whereas the rest of it subjects the other person to effective physical contact would, if you read the sentence as a whole, refer to offensive contact other than striking, shoving, kicking, or touching?
As I read the sentence as a whole, because the word contact or physical contact is not defined in H.R. Chapter 711 as being anything other than including its ordinary definition, I define subjecting another person to offensive physical contact as at the very least including or touching another person in an offensive manner as a part of subjecting another person to offensive physical contact. So I don't think it's necessarily not synonymous.
Why include it? Why did the drafters include it? I mean, if they meant only, offensive contact, why didn't they stop that in an offensive manner, period? What did they go on and say, subjects as opposed to touching?
That I don't know the answer to, but once again, I don't think it's necessarily surplusage.
We don't have any facts on the case because, you know, it got dismissed right at the beginning, but I'm kind of curious why you would even charge the second part of the statute. I mean, the vast majority of these cases involve strike, kicking, shoving. I mean, why did you even allege it?
Well, once again, the state's position is that it's not necessarily surplusage that other subjecting another person to offensive physical contact. And I think there's at least some people out there that would appreciate the further clarification of what is being charged here. So to that extent, it's not necessarily error to actually include it in the charge.
But in your brief, you admit or you concede that you're not concerned with the part that refers to subjecting a person to offensive touching. You're only actually charging the first part of 1A, striking or touching.
Yes, but I don't think subjecting a person is either inconsistent or suppressive with the first part of
I'm sorry, I don't understand your position. In your briefs, you concede that you're only talking about the first part. You're not talking about the second part. In fact, you take issue with Judge Nakamura. You say, well, he says alternative means, but you want to make it clear you're not charging alternative means.
Right.
You're only charging one of these, strike,
and when I say
shoves, kicks.
I'm really paraphrasing the first part of it. That's great.
Any reason aside from letting, the accused know about the full breadth of the statute for not just charging the striking, shoving, kicking, or otherwise touching another person? Just allege that, if that's all you meant to allege?
We could. I mean, it could be alleged as that. But once again, I mean, I don't mean to deflect from your question, Justice Kova, but the complaint in this case was dismissed without prejudice because of the foreign gender, because according to the trial court, through its reliance on footnote four genders, that the word or should have been and instead of leaving it as or, as opposed to why did you charge the extra stuff and charge it as is.
Why, in your position, doesn't footnote four of Gendrich mandate reversal in this case, or mandate us to affirm the ICA?
Because the conduct alleged in the offense here is factually synonymous. My interpretation of footnote four is that footnote four of Gendrich applies only if the words used in the charge are not factually synonymous.
And is that only if it's part of the same subsection of the statute, or could it apply if there were factually synonymous conduct, alternative means of committing the offense that occurred, that were identified in different parts of the statute, different sections?
I'm sorry.
The rule I'm trying to understand the rule that you're articulating. Does it matter that it's part of the same subsection of the statute or not?
It does.
In your position.
My interpretation of Gendrich is that it only applied the rule to different subsections of the statute. In fact, if you read Gendrich itself, the charge in that case, or the statute in that case, that was in effect at that time, actually was one subsection 1B and 1C of the disorderly conduct statute. And subsection 1C in particular says make any offensive, or said at that time, makes any offensively coarse utterance, gesture, or display, or addresses abusive language to any person present, which is likely to provoke a violent response. That subsection in and of itself has multiple possibilities, yet the according to Gendrich, at least in this footnote 4, didn't consider the word or in between the words gesture or display. So it's unclear to me whether or not Gendrich applies in this situation.
Now, you are arguing that we should adopt the view of Judge Nakamura and suggests, which it would, I take it in your view, would be a broader rule than what you've articulated here. In other words, what you've said here is as long as it's factually synonymous and it's in the same subsection, it's okay. Now, please describe for us the rule that you are advocating for based on Judge Nakamura's concurrence. Where would that apply and how much farther would it go?
The rule I'm advocating for is not so much necessarily focusing on such hyper-technicalities, such as whether or not the word and appears on the charge instead of the word or, but instead more taking a more reasonable approach to construing the charge, like Christian v. Alaska preferred that approach. And it would be the state's position that that would be a more reasonable approach, especially in light of MITA's general proposition that a charge should be what the statute describes with reasonable clarity the essential elements of the offense. A charge drawn in such language is sufficient. I think that is a more reasonable standard than.
So even if in different sections of the statute or subsections, and even if not synonymous or similar conduct, it could be charged in the disjunctive. Is that the state's position?
Yes.
Following up on what the CJA is asking you, that means you disagree with McCarthy, too, because in that case, it's one subsection, and the ICA found nine different alternatives,
yes,
including possibility of bodily injury to the complainant, to another person, damaged to various properties. I mean, it was nine, and you're okay with that?
Well, no. I disagree with McCarthy, but McCarthy is not really an issue here. And besides, it's not precedent, so this court's not, it doesn't need to be followed. But obviously, the trial court in this case found it persuasive.
What's the problem with and/or?
Well, it's unclear to the state how the word and provides any more notice than just using or, because if, for example...
No, I'm not talking about and,
right,
alone or alone, but I thought the ICA said and/or is fine.
And/or.
Yes.
Well, yes.
Both,
they said,
in other words, plead both.
Plead both, and/or. Yes, I believe Cabral said that it was most appropriate or something like that effect to... charge alternative means essentially with and or connecting the alternative means. In all candor, the state has a hard time understanding how and or provides any better notice than just using or.
Let me ask you, if a person is charged with, say, all the various subsections of the disorderly conduct, and the government just reads the charge with an or, then they're saying, as I understand it, the allegation would be, well, in good faith, because that's what the government needs to charge, and they have to comply with all the prosecutorial principles of, you know, they believe there's probable cause, it would seem to me, as long as they had a good faith belief that they could sustain one of the subsections, that would be okay under prosecutorial principles. But if they charge and, they have to have a good faith belief that they can prove each one. So it seems to me there's a huge distinction between or and in terms of what can be read.
I agree.
Then there is a big difference.
There is a big difference. So, once again, the words touching a person in an offensive manner are factually synonymous with the word subjecting another person to offensive physical contact. And moreover, the words strike, shove, and kick are factually synonymous with the word touch.
So, you reject the reading of this statute that says, you know, striking or touching is one way to commit the act, and the legislature meant to be all-inclusive, so they said, or subject the person to other offensive contact, meaning other than striking, shoving, etc. Anything else that would cause offensive contact. You think those two things are synonymous, and so the legislature was just adding surplusage to this and didn't mean to expand the statute beyond just actual touching?
I think it's the same or nearly the same. In other words, it's synonymous. Because ordinarily defined again.
How is a person to know what is factually synonymous or not? A person, common person charged with these crimes, if you talk about harassment or disorderly conduct, usually ends up in district court and hits a lot of people. How is a person of common knowledge supposed to know, having a complaint with it like this, what they're charged with, what he or she is charged with?
Well, the term factually synonymous was articulated by this court in Chandrish, I think.
No, but how is a common person supposed to know, looking at these charges, that they are supposed to be factually synonymous, if you say or.
Just by the meaning, ordinary definitions of the words used on both sides of or. Because a contact, physical contact, I would imagine.
Well, I mean, we have a disagreement here about whether they are, in fact, factually synonymous. How would a common person know, looking at these words, that they are supposed to be factually synonymous?
I don't understand the question. I apologize. Yeah. Yeah. The state would like to reserve the remainder of the time for rebuttal, if there's no further questions.
Any other questions at this time? Okay, thank you very much then. Mr. Jerome.
Thank you. May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Craig Jerome on behalf of the defendant, respondent, Marianne Cody-Amott. Good afternoon, Chief Justice Rechtenwald, Associate Justice of the Court.
Good afternoon.
You know, I find myself somewhat amazed at this point by the amount of consternation that's been caused by the presence or absence of three letters and a slash in this case and in other cases, but I do appreciate, and I know Ms. Cody-Amott appreciates this court giving this issue the weight that I believe it's entitled to. I believe this case does raise important constitutional considerations for criminal defendants in this state. And you know, I question whether the prosecution's arguments in this case present a situation where the prosecution needs to be careful what it asks for. We're asking the court to affirm the ICA's summary disposition order in this case on three bases. First of all, and based on State v. Pence and Diner, it's clear that the charge in this case described two disjunctive and alternative means of conduct by which HRS Section 711-1106-1A may have been violated. Secondly, it cannot reasonably be argued that the phrase or subjects the complaining witness to offensive physical contact as contained in the complaint was surplusage, because those words describe what is legally essential to this charge. It describes an essential element of the offense. And based on precedent, that can't be surplusage in a complaint. Finally, the rule that where a statute specifies several ways by which it may be violated, the charge may be in the conjunctive rather than a disjunctive, is supported by extraordinarily longstanding state and federal precedent. And this rule is required by both the state and federal constitutions. State v. Pence and Thiner expressly prescribes that contact with an individual's person by way of a strike, shove, kick, or other method of touching also prohibits and is disjunctive and alternative by conduct which subjects another person to offensive physical contact.
Mr. Jerome, can you address Chief Judge Nakamura's concurring opinion regarding whether, how using the term and instead of or affords the defendant more notice of what the defendant needs to be prepared to defend?
Well, the complaint needs to apprise the defendant of what the state is accusing him or her in this case of doing. And the state, in order to charge alternative means, needs to have a reasonable basis to believe that there's probable cause to support that the defendant violated the statute in both or all of those ways. So the defendant needs to be informed that the state is saying you did A and B, not that you did A or B.
And then the state would be, if the state did charge it as and, the state would be obligated to prove that the defendant struck and the defendant shoved and the defendant kicked and the defendant touched a person in an offensive manner and subjected the person to offensive physical contact?
No.
If they charged it in the conjunctive?
No, not under State v. Batson and not under cases that date back to the 1920s and the 1910s.
Well, then what do you mean that the state would be obligated to? Has to have a good faith basis to prove everything they charge in the conjunctive.
Well, they have to have good faith basis under the Hawaii Rules of Professional Conduct, Rule 3.8A. If they accuse someone of doing something, they have to have a good faith basis
sure,
to believe that charge.
Sure, but you said that if they charged an and, they have to prove everything that's in the conjunctive.
No, they have to have a good faith basis. That there's a probable cause to charge both. For instance, I mean, it may be simpler if we look at another type of offense like excessive speeding. I mean, I know the court's familiar with excessive speeding. Excessive speeding has two different alternative means, and everyone agrees that they're alternative means. The first of which is you're operating a motor vehicle at a speed that exceeds the posted speed limit by 30 miles an hour or more. The second is that you're operating a motor vehicle at a speed exceeding 80 miles an hour or more, regardless of what the posted speed limit is. If the state charges, and the state seems to have no problem in every excessive speeding case charging the defendant, if the defendant did both, charging and or in those types of cases. I've never seen an excessive speeding case that the complaint doesn't say and or. So if the defendant is traveling 85 and a 35 mile an hour speed limit, the state charges both. The state charges 30 miles an hour over the speed limit and operating at a speed exceeding 80 miles an hour. If the officer's ticket says the defendant was traveling 75 and a 35, the state charges the first alternative, but they don't charge the second alternative. If the defendant is traveling 80 miles an hour in a 55 mile an hour speed limit zone, they charge the second, but not the first. So if the state charges both, they have to have a probable cause to believe that the defendant was doing both, that he was traveling at greater than 80 miles an hour, and he was traveling at a speed that exceeds the posted speed limit by 30 miles an hour. So in this type of case, if you have a complaint that tells the defendant you did one or the other, the defendant's left not knowing what the state is accusing him of doing, how the state is saying that he violated the statute. And if the state doesn't have a good faith basis to believe.
But isn't the state's only required to prove one or the other? So isn't it being more forthright with the defendant to indicate through the use of the word or that the state only has to prove one or the other? In terms of a person's understanding of what's happening when they appear in court, wouldn't that provide them a more accurate picture of what indeed is happening? The state is saying it's going to prove it through one or the other means by the use of the word or. Because and implies the state's going to prove both, which in fact it doesn't have to do.
Well, there's an additional element in terms of the complaint is not just to tell the defendant what the state needs to prove in order to prove that he's guilty of the statute, of violating the statute. Otherwise, the complaint could just be on or about this date in the city and county of Honolulu, you, and then have the language of the statute. I mean, the purpose of the complaint is to let the defendant know what he's being accused of doing.
Well, the whole basis of your position is that if you say or, the person on the street will say or, well, that means it's one of these, not both. Yeah, it's one of these, right?
And or implies
and that so that the person would not have notice of which one of those he would be actually tried for.
That's correct. And or implies that it's one.
What's wrong with and slash or?
I don't think that there's anything wrong with and slash or. And I think
so is that your position, and slash or is okay?
My position, yes. Our position is that and is okay, or and slash or is okay, which is the position that's taken by the court in Batson, is that and or is preferable.
How does that give the defendant more notice than and, than or, this or not?
Because in or implies that it's one thing at the exclusion of all others.
Okay, can be one thing. It could be more than one thing also.
Well, if to take it out of the legal realm, if I say that I saw someone and they were wearing a blue suit or a red tie, the implication of the plain meaning of the word or is that they were not wearing both.
And so if the state charges it in the conjunctive, you are saying that the state would be obligated to prove the different ways that the statute can be violated if they use the conjunctive?
No, they don't. The state is not required to prove. In much the same way that in order to sustain a conviction, the state could choose to charge all of these offenses in alternative means in multiple counts.
In the conjunctive?
in the conjunctive, because Limahlu says if you charge in multiple counts, the implication is that they're being charged in the conjunctive.
And well, the whole theory is that the defendant, if he's charged with an, will be prepared when he goes or she goes to trial to defend against either one, right?
Yes, the defendant is prepared to defend against all of them.
Right, and the question of whether or not the prosecution has good faith, I'm not sure enters into the due process issue, I think, which we're concerned with, because we're looking at it from the point of view of how a person of common intelligence would view this document, not how a prosecutor or a defense attorney who knows all the law, et cetera, would view the document, correct?
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor.
So it doesn't matter if you plead an with respect to what the prosecution has to prove, because the prosecution knows that it only has to prove one, and the court knows that it only has to prove one. And if the jury comes back, if there's a jury and says, guilty, 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 and they're synonymous, then the court will dismiss all of them except for one, right?
That's correct. And Limahlu says that the jury has to be instructed that there's only
which sort of raises the question here in this case. If the prosecution has conceded that this case is only based on the first part of the phrase and that they don't intend at all to prove the second part of the phrase, was this complaint filed in good faith?
Not knowing anything about the evidence in this case or what?
No, you have a concession. Yours is a complaint. It says the first part, strike or touch, or subject a person to offensive contact. In their briefs, they say, we're charging really only the first. We're not at all concerned with the second because we're not charging that, but they charge it. Is that good faith?
I see how that raises a good faith concern. I'm hesitant to say that it's bad faith and that now the state seems
I didn't ask you that. I said, is that good faith?
And again, based on what I know about the case, I'm not sure that I can make that call. It seems like that would be bad faith, but it also seems to me that the state is arguing.
So does it even matter? That's what I'm asking you. You know, we're talking about good faith, bad faith. In a sense, it matters. But from the perspective of this case and due process, does it really enter into our ultimate decision?
I don't think it matters for the purposes of this case. It matters.
So we're really only looking at due process and notice to the defendant and the ability to defend properly or be able to defend a trial.
Yes, sir. And I think the only reason it came up is because of the concern that was raised by Justice Pollack that if the state charges a bunch of things as or, they can then argue that we weren't acting in bad faith because we never said the defendant did all of these things.
Have you ever filed a bill of particulars when you're faced with a pleading like this?
I have not, personally.
Okay. Do you know of situations where somebody's filed a bill of particulars?
Yes.
And what's the position of the prosecution when that happens?
The position of the prosecution when that happens is generally that they don't need to issue a bill of particulars because they intend to charge, or they intend to try to prove both, that they're not electing one means of proving the offense.
So nothing changes then if they don't, the judge. Well, just speaking from personal experience, very rarely do I ever see a court grant a bill of particulars, even where it's in the disjunctive. In fact, I can't remember one. But if the court won't grant a bill of particulars, and you're charged in the disjunctive, so when you go to trial, you still don't know, theoretically, what you're faced with, right?
That's correct. And, you know, I think as a practical matter, it is extremely rare for a court to grant a motion for a bill of particulars.
Why is that?
I don't know why that is, other than that the position of the courts and the position of the prosecutor seems to be that we've charged all of these things, we have a good faith basis to try to prove all of them, and we don't need to elect.
Oh, we know in this case there's no good faith basis, at least for the second part of the charge.
That's correct. And at the time, at the time we moved to dismiss, I assume we weren't aware of that. Because because it's so early in the proceedings, and the state doesn't concede that at their hearing on the motion or at the motion for reconsideration.
Is it your experience that these cases are being charged basically automatically and using all of the language of that? In other words, instead of stopping at strikes, shoves, kicks, or otherwise touches, it just automatically goes on to the next phrase when they could be separated?
I don't believe that I've ever seen a 1A harassment that doesn't charge all of the language. And, I conceivably the state, if there's no evidence of a kick, if there's no evidence of a shove, and it's just striking, they could just charge strike. But I understand why they don't do that, because it's or otherwise touch. I mean, conceivably they could just charge you did touch a person in an offensive manner without the examples.
But as a matter of fact, Mr. Jerome, you're not saying that they needed to drop out the subjected to offensive physical contact. You're just saying that they should have expressed it in the conjunctive.
I'm sorry, I got confused by.
On the 711-1106-1A, your argument hasn't been that subjects the other person to offensive physical contact should have been dropped. Wasn't your argument that it needs to be expressed in the conjunctive?
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Using either and or. And the point with the and or is what Batson says is that the or in and or is subsumed within the conjunctive and. So basically,
how is and or understandable to an ordinary person? I mean, coming into a courtroom and hearing this and or, how does that get them closer to the truth of what's happening than or, which actually is what's happening, because the state can prove it by either means?
It gets them closer to the truth of what happens, because I think for a person of ordinary understanding, again, if you say you did A and B, that means that we believe you did both. If you say you did A or B, that means we believe you did one or the other, but not both. If you say you did A and or B, that means we're saying you did one or the other or both. So the defendant at that point understands that there's at least some accusation that he did both of these things. And it becomes, I think it is clear to a person of common understanding the phrase and or. I don't believe it's necessarily grammatically correct, but I believe that as the English language has progressed, it's become more acceptable to use the word and or. And I think people of ordinary understanding understand. I do believe it gives the defendant more notice that, we're saying you did both of these things, but even if you only did one of them, that's really all we need to know. And I don't think it can ever be perfect.
Suppose a defendant, a male, is charged with, you slapped that woman and you punched her. And the guy is saying, I slapped her, but I did not punch her, so I am pleading not guilty. Don't you think that the person of average normal understanding would think, they're saying I did both and I didn't do both. So, and they have to prove that I did both. How does putting a conjunctive give the defendant more notice that you only have to prove one?
Well, in the vast majority of these cases, before someone's allowed to plead guilty, or before they go to trial, the court's at least going to have them consult with an attorney.
Yeah, aren't we supposed to talk about a person of normal understanding in assessing the charge, not what you understand after the attorney? Because obviously, Ms. Cordillo-Mack clearly understood after she had a talk with her attorney that they only had to prove one. So if that was the standard, we wouldn't be here today. So isn't it what the person of normal understanding would think?
Yes, but I think we can't say that it's more important that they know that the state only has to prove one than it is that they know what the conduct they're being charged with or the result of the conduct they're being charged with is. I don't think the fact that they may be confused about what the state has to prove is more important than them being confused about what they're actually being accused of doing.
Well, we're talking here about and or with respect to statutory language, right? Not with respect to specific acts.
Yes, sir. I mean.
And so if that's what we're talking about, then we're looking basically at the statutory language itself.
Yes.
And, you know, you don't necessarily have to get an attorney, and maybe people don't get an attorney if it's charged with a petty misdemeanor, like harassment or disorderly conduct, where a lot of these issues arise. So, in effect, they would have to depend on their own reading of the complaint.
Well, I believe that's true at the arraignment and plea stage, when they're first being arraigned.
You mean everybody gets an attorney?
I believe everyone is at least referred to the public defender's office. There are, in district court for criminal offenses, I mean, not.
And if they don't qualify, then they can represent themselves?
They can represent themselves.
And they often do.
I honestly, Your Honor, I wouldn't say that they often do.
Well.
Not on charges like harassment, perhaps on charges like driving without a license or other traffic offenses, the court is more likely to allow them to waive their right to counsel, but not for a charge like harassment, just in my experience. And I, you know, the important thing is that.
When does the right to an attorney kick in?
I believe the right to an attorney kicks in at the arrest stage.
No, I'm talking about in terms of imprisonment. Length of imprisonment.
Any term of imprisonment.
Any.
Yes, sir. The right to a court-appointed attorney.
Does it matter that the alternative means of violating the statute appear in the same subsection? And the reason I'm asking that is in Gendrich, the alternative means that were issued, I believe, were actually two different subsections of the statute. Here, the language that we're discussing today is all part of one subsection. So would you be, in essence, arguing for an extension of Gendrich? And if so, why should we extend it in that manner?
I don't believe we're arguing for an extension of Gendrich. I don't believe it matters whether it's in the same subsection or if it's in different subsections, because it's the question is whether or not it's alternative means, not whether the legislature has chosen to make it two separate subsections or the same subsection. And, you know, off the top of my head, you know, in State v. Batson is a murder by omission and murder by commission case, and I don't believe that there's a separate statute or subsection that applies to murder by omission versus murder by commission. It's just the means of causing the death. And State v. Batson says that, you know, that wasn't the issue in State v. Batson. The issue in State v. Batson is whether or not the state, because they charged both, in the conjunctive was required to prove both, but State v. Batson specifically says that the charge must be laid out in the conjunctive but not in the disjunctive.
A state of mind is charged in the disjunctive, isn't that correct?
I mean,
routine. And why is that okay, but what's happening here not okay, in your view?
In my view, and I'm willing to concede that in my view that is okay, and I think that's when we get into these ideas of what's hyper-technical pleading versus technical pleading.
Well, this court has held that state of mind is not an element. Isn't that the reason?
That's a very good reason why.
Well, I don't know if it's a good reason, but isn't that the reason? I mean, it's not an element, so you know.
Yes, and it's not an element, and the defendant should know that the state is only, basically, if you're charged with intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly, anything beyond recklessly is kind of surprising at that point.
There's quite a difference between a intentionally or knowingly and alternative ways of committing a crime. I mean, when we start talking about alternative ways, unlike intentionally or knowing, we require an Arceo instruction. There has to be unanimity when we're talking about alternative ways of how someone can be convicted of a crime. So it's quite a bit different than saying intentionally or knowingly.
Yes. So, you know, to make it clear, our position is that State v. Penzenthiner mandates that this is an alternative means, that they're two separate alternative means. A long history of precedent in this jurisdiction dating back to 1904 with Territory v. Richardson, federal precedent dating at least back to 1874 with the confiscation cases, which is cited in Territory v. Leahy, all make it clear that alternative means must be charged in the conjunctive rather than the disjunctive. And that precedent has been pretty much unquestioned in this jurisdiction. And I don't believe that there's any need to revisit it at this point in time. And the basis for that precedent has always been a defendant's constitutional right to notice, adequate notice of the charges against him, as well as some double jeopardy concerns. So we are asking the court to affirm the ICA's summary disposition order in this case, which dismissed the complaint in this case in district court without prejudice. So if the court doesn't have any further questions, I will excuse myself.
What about the Penzenthiner? Was that really an evaluation of, in the context of whether the defendant was apprised of the charges against him? Is that how that case? Wasn't that an insufficiency of evidence case?
Yes, Your Honor. And the issue in Penzenthiner was whether or not the state, there was sufficient evidence to conclude that he had violated the statute.
So how does that apply in our case when it's a notice of the charge case?
Because Penzenthiner holds that the two subsections or the two means in Penzenthiner are alternative and disjunctive. The interesting thing to me about Penzenthiner is in Penzenthiner, the state actually argued that the conduct in that case comprised the first part of touching the complaining witness in an offensive manner, and the court said, by any construction of the plain meaning of that term, this conduct cannot fit within that part of the statute.
And it was a case of statutory interpretation, isn't that correct?
Yes. So, but if, you know, if the state wants to argue that the type of conduct that's at issue in Penzenthiner is not covered by Section 711-1106-1A, I think that that's an example of them. They should be careful what they ask for, because there's all sorts of ways that one can subject a person to offensive physical contact without actually touching them. And those get charged an awful lot in district court. Spitting on someone, throwing paint on somebody, knocking their hat off, pulling on their necktie. And the ICA in Penzenthiner says, you know, there's no way that the conduct touching something appurtenant to somebody's body fits within touching somebody in an offensive manner. So, you know, I don't think there's a real basis for this court to conclude that those two phrases in Section 711-1106-1A mean the same thing, or they cover the same type of conduct. And because they don't cover the same type of conduct, I believe that they need to be charged in the conjunctive, if they're charged together. So were there any other questions?
Okay, there being no further questions, thank you, Mr. Jerome. Mr. Ito, your rebuttal.
I actually have nothing further to add than what was already argued before, as well as what was already set forth in the state's opening brief, as well as its application and reply. So if there are no further questions.
Just one. The charges are all on computers, right, in your office? I mean, is there any reason why they couldn't just put in and? Instead of using the word or, and could have been inserted. I mean, you have so much precedent, and what's resulted is a dismissal. Your case gets, and then years of appeal, and then we're back, and it just seems care might have prevented all of this.
Well, Mr. Ito, I may have mistaken what Mr. Jerome said, but I thought he said that if you could charge in the conjunctive, the prosecution has a good faith basis to prove all the charges in the conjunctive. I thought that's what he said. So would that be why you wouldn't charge in the conjunctive?
That would be one reason why.
But then your position is that that means you can prove either one then. So if you don't have a good faith basis for one of them, why are you charging it?
Well, we charge alternative means cases ordinarily. We can't withhold them. I think that with this charge in particular, and by the way, by using the word or instead of and, at least lets the defendant know that this particular criminal law can be proved by either means. So if it lets the defendant know that the offense can be proved in either means, it would behoove the defendant to prepare a defense for either alternative. In this particular criminal offense, I don't believe that a physical contact is necessarily so not actually synonymous with a touching that cannot be charged in the complaint.
Let me ask you this, and you may not know the answer. Does your office, when it gets this type of case, are they automatically charging? Mr. Jerome indicated his experience was he's seen it. They've always charged both parts of the statute. Is it your experience that they actually take a look and decide we're going to go under the kicking if that's all we have, or we're going to, if it's a type of case where they're grabbing a tire, spitting, they use the latter half, or it's been your experience, you charge the entire statute whenever you use this subsection?
Well, this particular charge in this case did charge the entire statute, but it's my understanding that right now we are narrowing it down.
Okay, well that's a...
I'm sorry, could you repeat what you just said?
This charge in this particular case did charge the entire statute, but it's my understanding that right now we are narrowing it down.
You know, if we look at this statute, like lawyers are supposed to look at statutes, the first part of it, strikes, shoves, kicks, or otherwise touches another person, that phrase, otherwise touches another person, must mean that otherwise touches another person must mean acts similar to strike, shove, kick, right? You have a general description preceded by specific right. examples.
Right.
Right? Just them generous.
Right.
So that when we say otherwise touches another person, that has to be referencing acts that are similar to strike, shove, and kick, right?
Not necessarily. I think if someone spits on somebody, that could also be a touching.
Oh, wouldn't that come under the second part, which is sort of like exclusio unis, whatever?
Well, I mean, we
Or subjects the other person to an offensive physical contact. That is, you know, the cases other than that which were preceded in the description of the offense. Anything, in other words, anything other than touching.
Yes, like, for example, someone shoving some person A into person B.
Yeah. So that makes them different, not synonymous, right?
Well, if we're defining the word synonym as the same or nearly the same, I think it's not so dissimilar that it's not synonymous.
I want to be sure I understand the rule that you're advocating for. In this particular case, the charge was 711-106-1A. That's how it was charged. There are a number of other sections in the harassment statute. Is it the state's position that the state could have literally charged every one of these other sections? So in addition to striking, shoving, kicking, otherwise touching, subjecting to offensive physical conduct, or insulted, taunted, or challenged, or repeatedly made telephone calls, or repeatedly made communications anonymously, it keeps going on. Is it your position that it could charge, the state could charge, every one of those alternative means in the disjunctive, and that would not be a problem?
If this court were to adopt a reasonable standard, I believe it would.
That is the rule the state's arguing for.
Yes.
And that's your understanding of the rule that Judge Nakamura was advocating for.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your response?
Well, I believe if this court will adopt a reasonableness standard, then such could be looked at under that standard. So I'm not,
When you say reasonableness.
We don't actually charge that. To my knowledge, that we don't actually charge.
When you say reasonableness standard, what do you mean? So just so we're sure we understand.
For example, Christian V. State's reference to a reasonable approach as opposed to relying on finding fatal defects in a charge based on hypertechnicalities. Or more specifically, Mita's reasonable looking at whether the charge itself is phrased in language in statute provides reasonable clarity of the essential elements of the defense act, unmistakable, and so on and so forth.
Okay, well, when you say adopts a reasonable standard, meaning in what your view, a reasonable approach to this area is to have a disjunctive rule. That's what you're talking about. In other words, we're not.
I think the phrasing, if this court is going to be adopting a reasonable standard, then I think phrasing discharge in a disjunctive is reasonable.
Okay. Now, so say again, every one of these sections was charged or subsections was charged. Wouldn't you agree that a person who walks into district court and hears a charge like that would be, at best, confused by what it is that they are supposed to be responding to?
Is this hypothetically speaking? Yes.
Okay. And what's the state's position about how that confusion should be cleared up, if at all? Maybe the state's position is it's not an issue.
Well, the state has the basis to charge each subsection of the harassment statute.
So your position would be the state has to have a good faith basis before it can charge one of the subsections?
Well, yes. If the state does have a good faith basis to charge each subsection, then it's charged. How it could further be clear, if it's unclear, otherwise unclear to the defendant, I don't know.
So the state has to, you would concede the state has to have a good faith basis to charge a particular subsection?
Yes. Based on this interpretation.
But it would only apply to the subsections itself, not to the differences between strike, shove, kick.
Right.
Even if you had no evidence of a kick, you could still charge him.
Well, my view is that the word strike, shove, kick, don't even need to be there. It's surplusage because this particular subsection is not charging a strike, shove, or kick per se.
Okay, so the state can charge, the state would have to have a good faith basis for talking about repeatedly making telephone calls. If the state had no reason to think there were telephone calls, this was two people who ran into each other in the street, first time they ever met, there would not be a good faith basis for charging repeated telephone calls, right?
Oh, yes.
Shouldn't be charged. Okay, but even if all the evidence suggests that there was a punch in the face and nobody kicked anyone, it would be okay for the state to charge the kick? And why is that? How would you draw that? What's the principal reason for that distinction?
The way I look at it, the word strike, shove, or kick provide, as I set forth in my opening brief, just provide merely provide illustrative examples of what could constitute an offensive touching. And from a standpoint of a person of common understanding, I think there are some people out there that would appreciate such illustrations to understand what they're being charged with.
So because they're conduct of the same kind,
right,
it serves a legitimate purpose by illustrating, providing examples of that type of conduct. Is that would be why it would be okay to charge all of those different means, even though the state perhaps didn't have evidence to suggest there was a kick? Is that, I'm just trying to understand your position. Is that what the position would be?
Yes.
Thank you.
There are no further questions.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. The court will take this matter under advisement.